Welcome to a special issue of the Abstract Podcast, Equine Surgery. I'm Alex, here in the US.
And I'm Sarah, in the UK. Instead of our usual weekly dive into the latest PubMed listings, we're taking a deep dive, journal club style approach.
That's right. Over the next half hour, we'll be covering the May and June 2026 print issues of three key journals in our field. We'll be looking at Asterisk Veterinary Surgery, the Asterisk Equine Veterinary Journal, and Times Equine Veterinary Education. We've sifted through the tables of contents to bring you the most relevant surgical papers.
We'll break them down paper by paper, looking at the science and what it means for those of us on the clinic floor. Let's get started with veterinary surgery.
First up, in Veterinary Surgery, Volume 55, Issue 4, is a paper from Sanchez Arjona and colleagues at North Carolina State University. It's a retrospective on using a diode laser for distal tarsal joint ankylosis, or bone spavin.
This is a retrospective cohort study looking back at 64 cases over a decade. They compared three techniques: laser alone, laser with drilling, and laser with cuboidal bone fenestration. The outcome assessment was a client telephone survey, which is a significant limitation. It introduces recall bias and subjective owner perception, which isn't as robust as a lameness evaluation by a blinded clinician. The long follow-up of a median of 5 years is a strength, but the non-randomized nature of the treatment groups makes direct comparison tricky.
Clinically, this is quite useful. The headline is that 83% of horses improved and 64% returned to their previous athletic level, which is a solid number for this condition. The key takeaway for surgeons is that combining the laser with cuboidal bone fenestration seems to offer the best of both worlds: good athletic outcomes and, importantly, a reduced need for a second surgery compared to using the laser alone. It reinforces that facilitating communication between the bones is key, and this laser fenestration combo is a good, minimally invasive way to do it.
Staying in veterinary surgery, we have a paper by McCoy and colleagues from the University of Illinois on the natural progression of tarsal osteochondrosis in standardbreds. This is a longitudinal observational cohort study, a strong design for tracking disease over time. They radiographed 148 standardbred foals every 2 months from 2 to 12 months of age. My main critique is that while they looked for an association with gait pacing versus trotting, they found foals spent less than 1% of their time doing either. This makes it impossible to draw any meaningful conclusions about the biomechanical effects of a specific gait. The study is also limited to one breed at one location, which may affect generalizability.
For surgeons, this is a powerful reminder to hold your horses, so to speak. Tarsal OC lesions were present in nearly 70% of these foals at 2 months, but most of them, about 85% of the ones that healed, did so by 6 months of age. This confirms that the critical window for these lesions to resolve on their own is very early in life. The practical message is clear. Don't rush to arthroscopy for tarsal OC in a very young foal. Give it time. Conservative management and monitoring until at least 6 months of age is the evidence-based approach. All right, that wraps up veterinary surgery. Let's move on to the Asterisk Equine Veterinary Journal.
Indeed. The May 2026 issue, Volume 58, Issue 3, has a bumper crop of surgical and imaging papers. First is a study by Brown and colleagues on risk assessment for condylar fractures in thoroughbreds using standing court. This is a retrospective clinical study using finite element analysis, a type of virtual mechanical testing on SCT images. The methodology is advanced, but the major weakness is the tiny sample size, just 9 limbs from 7 horses. This makes it more of a proof of concept than a definitive study. The authors also acknowledge their model doesn't account for whole joint physiology, which is a simplification of a complex biological system.
Even with the small numbers, this is where the future is heading. We use standing CT to find early subchondral bone injury, but interpreting the risk is subjective. This study showed that their objective, virtual strain analysis, lined up with the subjective clinical risk assessment used by Racing Victoria. For the surgeon in the field, it means we're getting closer to an objective tool that could tell us, this horse's bone is under too much strain, it needs a break now, before a catastrophic fracture occurs. It's not ready for prime time yet, but it's a very promising development. Next in EVJ, DeBald and colleagues look at racing and sales performance in thoroughbred yearlings after carpal osteochondral fragment, or CHIP, removal.
This is a retrospective observational study comparing 26 surgically treated yearlings 20 conservatively managed ones, and a control group of 138 match siblings. The retrospective nature and the non-random assignment to treatment groups are the main limitations. Owners who opt for surgery might be more invested in racing the horse, introducing a significant selection bias. The sample size of affected horses is also quite small.
The practical implications are nuanced but important. Having a carpal chip, regardless of treatment, negatively impacts sales price and winnings compared to a clean sibling. However, the crucial finding for surgeons is that surgically removing the chip made a horse significantly more likely to actually start a race compared to leaving it in. The odds ratio was over 6. While surgery didn't make them champions, it appeared to salvage a racing career that might otherwise not have happened. So when advising an owner, you can say surgery offers the best chance of getting the horse to the track.
Now for something a bit different, an ophthalmology paper from Graham and colleagues at the University of Liverpool, but one that's highly relevant for any surgeon placing a subpalpebral lavage or SPL system. This is a prospective, randomized treatment trial, which is a great study design. I randomized 73 SPL systems to either the upper or lower eyelid and monitored for complications. Randomization by coin toss is simple but effective. The main limitation is the relatively small study size, which the authors acknowledge. This might explain why the primary outcome, any complication, wasn't significant, but the secondary outcome of major complications was.
This is immediately applicable in practice. For years, people have debated whether to place SPLs in the upper or lower lid. This study gives us a clear answer. While overall complication rates are similar, major complications, like the footplate dislodging, are 5 times more likely with upper eyelid placement. Therefore, unless there's a specific reason not to, we should be placing these in the medial lower eyelid. It's a simple change that can reduce the risk of significant problems for the patient. Next, an important welfare paper from Mellish and colleagues studying tracheal collapse in Kenyan working donkeys.
A cross-sectional study comparing 38 cart donkeys with 28 pack donkeys. They performed physical exams and standing endoscopy, with the endoscopic recordings reviewed by blinded evaluators, which is a methodological strength. The main limitation is that the endoscopy was performed at rest. Dynamic endoscopy during work would have provided a more complete picture of airway obstruction, but obviously that's a huge logistical challenge in this setting.
This paper highlights a severe welfare issue with surgical relevance. It demonstrates a strong link between the harness design of carts, which puts pressure on the mid-cervical region, and moderate to severe tracheal collapse. 40% of the cart donkeys had grade 3 collapse, compared to 0% of the pack donkeys. The practical takeaway is twofold. First, it validates that physical exam findings like thickened skin over the neck are good predictors of underlying tracheal damage. Second, it underscores that this is a man-made problem that could potentially be addressed with better harness design, a form of preventative medicine that precedes any surgical intervention.
We're back to high-end athletes now, with a paper from Vaughn and colleagues at UC Davis on the ultrasonographic diagnosis of humeral stress fractures. This is a clinical case series, which sits lower on the evidence hierarchy. The major limitation is the small sample of just 7 horses, and not all of them underwent the gold standard test, scintigraphy, for comparison. The lack of a control group means we can't determine the specificity of the ultrasound findings. However, for a condition that can be catastrophic, descriptive data like this is still valuable.
Absolutely. Scintigraphy is expensive and not widely available, so finding a practical alternative is a big deal. This paper shows that ultrasound can be a very useful tool for this injury. They identified the fracture line in 9 out of 10 cases. Key things to look for are A. Step defect in the bone cortex, periosteal reaction, or an abnormally convex shape to the caudal humerus. For the practitioner, this means if you have a racehorse with an acute, severe forelimb lameness, reaching for the ultrasound probe to check the back of the humerus is a logical, accessible, and high-yield diagnostic step. Next up in EVJ is a paper from Tritao and colleagues looking at the etiology of EOTRH, or equine odontoclastic tooth resorption and hypercementosis.
This is a cross-sectional study in 154 older Icelandic horses, comparing blood parameters in affected versus non-affected animals. Study is limited by its design. A cross-sectional study can only show association, not causation. Also, blood was only sampled once, and they didn't perform dynamic endocrine testing like a TRH stim. which could have provided more detailed information. The control group was also much smaller than the EOTRH-affected group, which can affect statistical power.
For clinicians, this paper is useful for what at times didn't find. Despite extensive blood work, there were no systemic markers that could predict or explain EOTRH here. There was no evidence of systemic inflammation or significant metabolic disturbances. The conclusion is that EOTRH appears to be a primarily local disease process within the mouth. So our focus should remain on local factors, oral examination, and radiography for diagnosis and management. We can stop chasing systemic causes for now.
The next two papers in EVJ form a nice pairing, both looking at respiratory pressures during exercise. First, Strand and colleagues on diagnosing Elipsler fold collapse. This is a prospective clinical study in 21 standardbreds. They used nasopharyngeal airway pressure measurements before and after temporarily suturing the alar folds back, which is a clever, inbuilt control. This provides an objective measure to supplement subjective endoscopic findings. The methodology is sound, though not all horses were available for postoperative testing, which would have fully closed the loop.
This is a fantastic tool for objectively confirming a diagnosis that can sometimes be ambiguous. The key finding was that a Kurler fold collapse causes a significant times expiratory times obstruction. Temporarily tying the folds back resulted in a big drop in expiratory pressure. So for a practitioner with access to this equipment, you can definitively tell an owner, yes, this is the problem, and here is the data showing how much it improves with intervention. It moves the diagnosis from a subjective opinion to an objective measurement, which is always a win. And following on from that, Vermettel and colleagues provide reference values for tracheal pressures in healthy harness racehorses.
This is a prospective observational study in 76 clinically normal trotters. Establishing reference ranges is crucial work. The main limitation, which they state, is the lack of simultaneous airflow measurements. Pressure alone doesn't tell the whole story of respiratory mechanics. Pressure combined with flow allows calculation of resistance, which is a more complete measure of obstruction. However, measuring airflow is technically much more challenging.
This paper is the essential counterpart to the previous one. To know what's abnormal, you first need to know what's normal. They provide reference values for peak inspiratory and expiratory pressures during a standardized treadmill test. A clinically important finding was that pressures became significantly more negative, meaning more obstruction, when the horses were in pole flexion compared to a free head carriage. This gives us objective data to support what we often see endoscopically and provides a baseline to quantify the severity of issues like laryngeal hemiplegia or dynamic collapse.
Next, a paper on antimicrobial use in standing cheek tooth extractions by Schneider and colleagues. This is a retrospective analysis of over 300 cases. A key methodological point is that they used multivariable logistic regression, which is the correct way to untangle multiple risk factors. However, as with any retrospective study on treatment, there's a huge potential for confounding by indication. That is, the vets likely gave antimicrobials to the cases they perceived as higher risk, making it difficult to truly assess the effect of the drugs themselves on complication rates.
This is a great paper for promoting antimicrobial stewardship. Complications occurred in about 18% of cases, but most were mild. Crucially, in the large number of horses that did not times receive antimicrobials, the complication rate was no higher. This supports the idea that we don't need to use prophylactic antimicrobials for routine standing extractions. The risk factors for complications were things you'd expect: pre-existing infection, fractures, and concurrent disease. So, the take-home is to reserve antimicrobials for those genuinely high-risk cases, not use them as a default. Now, a pharmacology paper from Blanton and colleagues at Texas A&M on the effects of pregabalin on anesthetic recovery.
This is a retrospective cohort study comparing 52 horses that received pregabalin with 76 controls. The recovery periods were scored by blinded reviewers, which is a strength. The main weakness is the retrospective and non-randomized design. The anesthetist was not blinded and made decisions about using other drugs like butorphanol and acepromazine, which could significantly influence recovery times and confound the results.
The clinical message here is pretty clear. While pregabalin is useful for pre-appointment anxiolysis, especially for things like MRI, you need to be aware that it significantly prolongs recovery time. In this study, horses getting pregabalin took about 7 minutes longer to stand, which might not sound like a lot, but it can feel like an eternity when you're watching a horse recover. Interestingly, it didn't improve the quality of recovery, which was excellent in both groups. So, if you use pregabalin, just be prepared for a slightly slower but still good quality recovery.
The next paper, by Campana and colleagues, uses CT to look at changes in the central tarsal bone. This is a retrospective case series evaluating CT studies from 94 clinical cases. The use of a standardized 8-region system to localize lesions is a good methodological approach for descriptive work. The obvious limitations are the retrospective design, the lack of clinical correlation to determine the significance of the findings, and the absence of histopathology to confirm the nature of the lesions described. The population was also mostly warm bloods, which may limit applicability to other breeds.
This paper gives us a detailed roadmap of where to look for trouble in the central tarsal bone. The key finding is that the proxima dorsomedial region, that's the top, front, inside part of the bone, is a major predilection site for sclerosis. And where you see severe sclerosis, you are significantly more likely to find demineralization and associated fractures. So for the surgeon interpreting a tarsal CT, this tells you to pay extremely close attention to that specific spot. It's a hot spot for pathology that can lead to slab fractures. And the final paper from this issue of EVJ is a scoping review by Deschaize-Martin and colleagues on comminuted fractures of the proximal phalanx, or P1.
A scoping review is a systematic way to map the existing literature. They identified 39 papers covering 409 cases. The strength is in the synthesis of a large amount of fragmented information. The weakness, inherent to the source material, is that all the included studies were retrospective, with varying definitions and follow-up, which makes robust conclusions difficult. They did appropriately use statistical analysis to compare outcomes between fracture types and treatments where possible.
This is a fantastic summary for any surgeon faced with one of these challenging fractures. The key clinical distinction is between moderately comminuted fractures, which have an intact strut of bone, and severely comminuted ones, which don't. For the moderate ones, lag screw fixation gives the best survival rate at 85%. For the severe ones, perhaps counterintuitively, conservative management with cast immobilization alone actually had a better survival rate than complex surgical plating. This review provides crucial data to help guide treatment decisions and have an informed discussion with owners about prognosis.
And that concludes our look at the Asterisk Equine Veterinary Journal. We'll finish this special episode with a tour through equine veterinary education.
That's right. The June 2026 issue, Volume 38, Issue 6, has a mix of clinical commentaries, case series, and reviews. First up is a piece by the legendary Jörg Auer on the significance of rudimentary ulnas in foals with angular limb deformities.
This piece is essentially a clinical commentary or opinion piece responding to a recently published case report. As such, it's not original research and doesn't have a formal methodology to critique. Its strength lies in the author's vast experience and logical deconstruction of the opposing argument. It serves as an important scientific rebuttal, reminding us to be critical of case reports that may draw overly strong conclusions from limited evidence.
And the practical take-home is incredibly clear. Dr. Auer argues that in most foals, an ossified rudimentary ulna is just an incidental finding, not the cause of their carpal valgus. He makes the case that the real culprit is often incomplete ossification of the cuboidal carpal bones. The message for clinicians is, don't get sidetracked by the ulna. Focus on getting good orthogonal radiographs of the carpus and assess the cuboidal bones properly. That's where the real problem, and therefore the correct treatment, usually lies.
Next is a retrospective case series from Marco Serralta and colleagues on osteochondral necrosis of the medial femoral condyle in foals. This is a small retrospective case series of 12 foals. The main limitations are the small number of cases and some incomplete records, which is common in retrospective work. They devised a radiographic grading system but found no association with survival, likely due to the lack of statistical power. Without a control group, it's difficult to definitively say why some foals survived with conservative management and others didn't.
Despite the poor overall prognosis for this condition, this paper offers a glimmer of hope. It documents three survivors who were managed conservatively. Historically, this diagnosis has been a death sentence. The key seems to be judicious case selection. While arthroscopic debridement had a poor outcome in this series, it appears that some foals, if managed with rest and supportive care, can heal. The clinical takeaway is not to give up immediately. For foals with this condition, Careful monitoring with serial radiographs under conservative care might be a viable option for a select few. Next up in EVE is a case report from Stemmett and colleagues about excising an osteochondroma from the tarsal sheath.
As a single case report, its methodological value is in demonstrating a specific technique. We can't draw generalizable conclusions from an N of 1. However, the report highlights the value of advanced imaging, specifically CIT, for detailed preoperative planning in a complex anatomical location. The description of the tenoscopic approach is clear and adds to the surgical literature.
For the surgeon, this is a great reminder that osteochondromas don't just happen on the back of the radius. When you have a persistent, localized tenosynovitis, especially in an unusual spot, you need to consider an underlying bony abnormality. This case shows how a tenoscopic approach can be used to excise a mass from within the tarsal sheath, offering excellent visualization and minimally invasive access, which is ideal for healing in such a high-motion area. It's a nice example of applying advanced diagnostics and minimally invasive surgery to solve an unusual problem.
Following that is a clinical overview on the etiology and management of clubfoot by the renowned farrier and veterinarian Stephen O'Grady and colleagues. This is a review article or clinical summary. It's not presenting new data, but is synthesizing existing knowledge and clinical experience. The critique here is less about methodology and more about the evidence base. A good review should ideally be systematic, but this appears to be more of a narrative or expert opinion-based overview. Its value lies in providing clear, practical guidance from a recognized authority on the subject.
And that guidance is crystal clear. This is a perfect paper for vets and farriers to read together. It boils down clubfoot management to two core principles. First, the farriery goal is to trim the heels to load the back of the foot and unload the toe. Second, if you do surgery, is specifically an inferior check ligament desmotomy. Light must be combined with that same aggressive heel trimming. Surgery alone is not enough. This paper provides a concise, unified approach to a common and often frustrating condition. Next is another interesting case report, this time from Merchan and colleagues, on bilateral stylohyoid fractures.
Again, as a case report, we're looking at a single data point. The report is well documented with radiographs and endoscopy. A particularly interesting aspect is the staged surgical approach, performing a unilateral serratohyoid disarticulation and then waiting to see if it was sufficient. This is a sound clinical decision-making process, avoiding unnecessary surgery on the contralateral side.
This is a fascinating case. We usually associate stylohyoid issues with temporohyoid osteoarthropathy and neurological signs. Here, the horse presented with primarily pharyngeal collapse and dysphagia. The takeaway for the clinician is to keep the hyoid apparatus on your differential list for horses with unexplained pharyngeal dysfunction. Radiographs are key. The surgical solution is also noteworthy. A unilateral procedure successfully treated a bilateral problem by reducing the mechanical stress on the healing fractures. It's a good example of how a less is more approach can sometimes be effective.
Now, a case of septic arthritis in a very unusual location, the cervical articular process joints, from Elcock and colleagues. This is a well-described case report that effectively integrates multiple imaging modalities, ultrasound to guide the synoviocentesis, radiography for initial screening, and CIT for detailed evaluation of the concurrent osteitis. The diagnosis was confirmed with synovial fluid analysis, which is the gold standard. The report provides a clear roadmap for diagnosing and treating this rare condition.
This case is a great reminder that joint sepsis can happen anywhere, not just in the limbs. A foal with acute neck stiffness and pain should have septic arthritis of a cervical facet on the differential list. This report demonstrates that an aggressive, multimodal approach can lead to an excellent outcome. Ultrasound was key to getting the diagnostic sample, and arthroscopic lavage, even in this tricky location, was successful. It shows that with timely and advanced care, we can save foals with what might have previously been considered a hopeless condition. And the final paper for our special issue is a consensus report from the Havemeyer Working Group on Equine Pain Assessment, led by Hopster and colleagues.
This is a consensus statement, which represents the collective opinion of a group of experts. It's not primary research, but it's incredibly important for guiding clinical practice. The process involved two meetings of international experts who reviewed the existing literature. The main critique of any consensus statement is that it can be subject to the biases of the individuals in the room, but the goal is to overcome that by bringing diverse perspectives together.
For every single one of us in practice, this is a call to action. The experts have reviewed all the complicated pain scales out there and have made a practical recommendation. Start using the equine pain scale or EPS. It's relatively simple and has been shown to be reliable. Their goal is to make pain assessment a core clinical vital sign, just like heart rate or temperature. The message is to stop trying to invent new tools and to start consistently using a standardized one so we can all speak the same language when it comes to equine pain and welfare.
And that brings us to the end of our special issue review. It's clear there's a huge amount of high-quality research constantly shaping our surgical practice.
Absolutely. From molecular-level risk assessment to practical tips on managing club feet, it's a great snapshot of the breadth of our specialty. We hope you found this deep dive useful. A quick reminder that the Abstract Podcast is produced by an AI, and our discussion is based on the abstracts alone. For full details, and to make your own clinical judgments, please read the full articles. We'll be back next week with our regular look at the latest from PubMed.